And this is KPCW. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's 8:06 on this Wednesday morning, December 10th. Currently 34 degrees here in Old Town Park City under mostly cloudy skies right now. Looks like that's going to be clearing up. 36 degrees under cloudy skies in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Wednesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back. We're looking at mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies out there for you for your Wednesday morning. We'll see more sunshine by your Wednesday afternoon. Temperatures will climb up to near 50 degrees for us in Park City, with high temperatures climbing into the mid-50s in the Heber Valley. As we go into your Thursday, look for plenty of sunshine. We'll start temperatures off into the upper 20s to low 30s across the Wasatch Back, and we'll see those high temperatures climbing into the low 50s in Park City. Highs will climb into the mid-50s in the Heber Valley. Temperatures starting off into the mid to upper 20s here for us as we get towards your Friday morning. But don't worry, we're expecting more of that sunshine in place across the area. That sunshine will help to boost those temperatures back up near 50 in Park City, and we'll see those highs holding into the low to mid-50s for us in the Heber Valley. The upcoming weekend, well, you guessed it, high pressure off the West Coast will continue to dominate our weather pattern, meaning we're not expecting a lot of big change out there. So we'll start off with temperatures for your Saturday morning in the 20s across the Wasatch Back, with high temperatures right around 50 degrees again in Park City. We'll see those highs into the mid-50s for us in the Heber Valley. By the time we get towards your Sunday, look for a few extra high clouds out there, so we'll call it partly cloudy skies. Temperatures starting off into the 20s with high temperatures in the low 50s in Park City. Highs will be back in the mid-50s in the Heber Valley. As we go into next week, we're going to be looking at that sunshine with a few high clouds each day, but overall fairly calm conditions. Highs in the upper 40s to near 50 in Park City, and we'll see those high temperatures climbing into the low to mid-50s, therefore, in the Heber Valley. Overall, it looks like we're going to stay with this well above average temperature trend and mainly dry pattern, at least through the middle of next week. There are signs by the time we get towards next weekend and beyond, we may see some change, but that's a few weeks away. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
And with a look in the backcountry, on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Center, I have Drew. Good morning, Drew.
Hey, morning, Leslie. You hate to make a joke, but winter seemed a little thin and skinny this year.
Yeah, sure does.
And yet there is 1 to 2 feet of snow blanketing the Wasatch Range, and folks can tiptoe around and scoot around to the backcountry. The danger is pegged at moderate, and that's primarily for the slab of snow that came in this last weekend. Sitting over the old October-November facets, they're becoming more difficult to trigger, a little bit more stubborn, but folks are still experiencing cracking and collapsing in the backcountry on that suspect layering. Again, if you do trigger one of these avalanches, it'll be probably 1 to 2 feet deep, maybe 100, 150 feet wide, and you may trigger these things at a distance, or what we call remotely trigger them. Again, and those are going to be most prevalent on westerly to northerly to easterly facing aspects above about 9,000 feet. So there was a pretty darn good widespread natural cycle in lockstep with the storm over the weekend, and particularly down in the Provo area mountains, some of these up to 1,500 feet wide. But the trend with the warming temperatures, not much going on in the snowpack, we'll probably trend towards low, maybe towards the weekend. And I sort of shudder to say this, but wet avalanches, Leslie, those might be on the menu in the coming days. So just sort of put on the mindset as if you're in the spring conditions, and if you're seeing rollerballs, the snow starts to feel punchy, unconsolidated under feet or ride, it's going to be time to change aspects or get to lower angle terrain. So you can get all this and more at utahavalanchecenter.org.
Okay, Drew, thanks so much.
Thanks, Leslie.
And stay tuned. In just a minute, I'll be checking in with State Representative Mike Kohler, get a recap of yesterday's special session. Later on, Utah State Senator Nate Blauen and a candidate running for the first congressional seat in Congress has the Democrats' response to yesterday's special session. Acting City Manager Jody Emery will be joined by Deputy City Manager Heather Steddon to preview this week's Park City Council meeting. And finally, from the Heber Valley Chamber, Public Relations Manager Jessica Turner with a rundown of some of the activities this month. The Utah State Legislature met in a special session yesterday, and on the phone with a recap of what happened, I have State Representative Mike Kohler. He represents Wasatch County as well as a portion of Summit County here in Park City. Thanks, Mike, for joining us. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so was it a long night or was business taken care of pretty quickly?
Oh, longer than I expected. I figured it'd take an hour and it took two, but it wasn't that long.
Okay. And it looks like there was quite a crowd that was there to, I don't know, sing some Christmas carols.
Yeah, I saw that on the news. There was a little noise from the outside. I didn't see the crowd, and now we had other meetings going on, so I didn't see it, but... Yeah, that's great to have so much enthusiasm, I suppose.
All right. Well, one of the issues that you dealt with was the repeal of the controversial bill, House Bill 267, that basically banned public employee unions. So why did you do this? I mean, the legislature considered it such a win when it was approved earlier this year.
Yeah. Well, and I guess most of the stuff we'll talk about today would probably land in your different course depending on where your political views are. So that's to be expected. So I'm going to give you where mine was. 267, when it came out originally, was somewhat controversial, obviously, because of the labor union attacks that it had. When it came to its final version, I guess, in the legislature, it included all of the public sector unions, including firemen and police and the UEA and schools and stuff like that. And it created, in my opinion, we were treating different types of union representation different. I've been in the county for many years and dealt with fire and police and those kind of things. And obviously most of us, our parents, have dealt with the UEA over time. And I thought they should have been handled separately, and I voted against the bill, expecting kind of to see somewhat of a coalition be created because of the joint attack. And that's what happened. And it obviously was unpopular. They created a referendum on it, created and gathered signatures quick. I wasn't involved in any discussion to repeal it, but it seemed obvious that it was going to, had already created enough controversy that I thought repealing it was a good move, just to get it off the table, and because it was taking a lot of time on other things that are better and for the, let's say, more informative or better for the communities and for our state.
Yeah. So, again, you voted against the bill when it was originally approved earlier this year, huh?
I did.
Yeah. It does sound like there was some fear that the legislature would have been overruled by voters, as you mentioned. They collected, I guess, more like a 250,000 signatures within the time frame, which was pretty impressive. But it sounds like there was some fear that the legislature would have been overruled by voters, and they really just wanted to, I guess, not see that happen? Or was it just, like you say, just to move on to other things?
It might have been overruled, and I guess you could say with that many signatures that quick, it was trending that way. I had three problems with it. Obviously, I think, as I first said, I think treating police and firemen and their negotiating ability, because they're dealing with different types of things, is one goal and one problem. Dealing with the UA is totally something else. Mm-hmm. And they should have been treated separately because they're different, they have different roles, and they play different roles in the operations of the groups that they represent. And so by putting them all in one package, we created, in my opinion, a assembly of, shall we say, both sides of it that became, I mean, how do you fight against teachers? How do you fight against police and firemen? I think the unions have to be treated a little bit different than the, and should be separated from the groups that they represent. And in the law, in the bill that was put forward, they were basically blocking what they're calling collective bargaining, but it was deeper than that for all of them. So they all became friends, and they've got to be handled separate. There's different problems to solve, and I think you'll see some bills coming out that will maybe handle them separately in the future. I don't know if it's going to happen soon because of the reaction here. But I think they all, each group should be treated differently and given, shall we say, different rules or different types of incentives to play with or to be more efficient or whatever you're trying to accomplish with the collective bargaining. It just created a coalition that was not focused on the problems of each one individually. That's what I saw from the front, and I think you'll see that those groups treated individually in the future if that happens again.
My understanding is leadership is meeting with the labor unions. Any idea of what kind of agreement we should see? I mean, it sounds like there may be some support for being dealt with individually.
I think there is. There's definitely some changes, especially with the individuals. We had lots of individual groups when the bill was out there. Lots of individuals with each group that felt they weren't represented, and that was in all groups, especially teachers. The UEA probably, I had more comments towards concerns with the UEA than any of the other three, but I got them from all three. And so there are aspects of the negotiating process that have become so commercialized or incorporated in the, shall we say, international or nationwide causes that the locals are left out in many cases. And so, yes, I think they all need some help. I think they need to be treated differently and individually.
Yeah. Should teachers feel targeted, though? I mean, by what you're saying, given that, I mean, they're the ones that did an amazing job getting out the protest and collecting the signatures.
Yeah, and I didn't really pay attention to who did it. I just knew that by the vote that we've had and by passing that bill, that we created a club of groups that generally wouldn't be together, and they were going to be very persuasive with the public. So I felt it was wrong right from the start. Doesn't mean the problem's solved, and it doesn't mean the problems that we're trying to solve with that bill are accepted by everybody. But each group needs some changes to get the individual represented in a better way. And I, again, we'll see what happens. It's not something I get involved in. As far as running a bill, those that do have been talking a little bit about possibilities of some incremental changes, and we'll see what happens.
All right. In other business, yesterday lawmakers approved a resolution condemning the courts for judicial activism. Do you feel that way? Are courts becoming active judges?
Well, honestly, I try to avoid the courts. I'm not that involved in them, but I would say this, and this again is one of those political things depending on which side you're on. The process of redistricting has been divisive from the start. They had the original referendum that created the better, what they call better boundaries or whatever, and so the state, because of the federal, legislature, because it's mandated in the Constitution, did our part, and we went around and had meetings all over the state. The other group did as well, as far as I know, and we put forward some rules. Now, under Proposition 4, some of those rules were quite different than what was what actually got put out. Now, as I understand it, and I'm not an insider on this, but I just watched what's going on, the original map that we put up was rejected by when the suit started, because we took ours instead of theirs. But yet, so was the original map put out by the Better Boundaries Commission. It didn't follow the Prop 4 either, and that was thrown out. So we put in ourselves, due to the judge activity there, or the decisions, put everybody into a really quick repeat cycle to try and create a map that would work, and to fit everything. And the rules that the legislature were given were basically the same as the Prop 4. You couldn't, first thing was you had to have them all equal. Second, you weren't supposed to break up any more than necessary cities and towns and counties, communities of interest, they called it. And you couldn't use political information or statistics. And so we created ours. I think they were very similar to what they'd been in the past, other than some adjustments for size. But in my opinion, it represented Utah the best. It made each district be required to have some rural and some urban, very urban and very rural, but it would mean that each one of our representatives, the four that were going to represent us, had a broad scope of the state. And it didn't use, if you would, we couldn't use and didn't show, and in my opinion, political activity or political statistics to try and bench or, shall we say, take advantage. That's again, my opinion. Somebody else, I'm sure, thinks very different. The one that came out from the other side, and again, there's lots of outside interest, outside of the state interest involved in these, but then circled, obviously, a very Democratic circle right in the middle of the state. And I don't know how you do that. If you gave the map or the rules to a 10-year-old and said divide the state up, and you have to have them all the same, you don't want to break up this, this, and this, but you can't use politics, they're not going to put a circle around Salt Lake. I mean, I think to say that theirs isn't gerrymandering or is, I think is very... just say you're ignorant of the situation or you're very political, either one, but it's disingenuous to say that. So that said, I don't know if you can ever get to an agreement where one is not considered political by somebody. Right. That said, we felt that it was worth saying that the judicial activity that has taken place basically took what the Constitution says is our responsibility away, and we wanted to reemphasize that.
Yeah. You don't feel like it was a scolding? The resolution, again, it's not binding law. It's just a message.
No, it's just a statement. A statement. There's nothing in there that's binding.
Right. But again, I mean, does it come down to like the lawmakers scolding our judiciary?
I think that's definitely how it could be interpreted, and it probably should be in some cases. In my opinion, and again, I voted for the resolution, obviously, but there's two or three things happening here. Number one is I think the judge that took over this case and was given the case definitely didn't go through the process in such a way as there was no politics in that side. Number one is they waited, put in a map that I thought was very much gerrymandered. Secondly, they waited till the last day, which was the 10th, which was the date that the lieutenant governor gave them, so there was no appeal process. That was all that was left. So there's many steps that were taken that seemed to me to be rigged for the side that they were creating.
All right.
So what this did is basically said, hey, it's our responsibility. Yes, the people we get to speak to, but we represent the people, and we were basically ignored. Then the other two bills kind of came in and said, all right, because of the appeal that we are going to do, and we are going to do it, we've got to get her, the judge to, Judge Gibson, I think it is, to finish the process and sign off. So we can move on an appeal. The stalling of that shows, which would indicate to me that they're again trying to run out the clock where you don't have a choice. But with the other two bills, basically made adjustments to the process by dropping the signature day or the sign-on date, declaration dates back on the four offices of the Congress, and then also the other one was to, but the other one was a little different. It kind of declared that. In order that we're going to be doing this appeal, gave the appeal process directly to the Supreme Court so that we didn't have to go through all this other stuff and wait for attorney fee declarations and other things.
Okay. So the argument to me, basically it comes down to, does the state legislature have full constitutional authority to draw redistricting maps? Both the state Supreme Court and the district court have said, no, it doesn't. And I guess it's like, why can't you just live with that?
Well, I guess there's two points. Number one is, in this case, I think you get if you do just give into it, then you have surrendered to a very, shall we say, a biased decision on the other side. So you've just advocated that, well, this was our decision. The state is mostly Republican, and I'm being very direct. I mean, it probably could be more nuanced, but the state is Republican. We put this together, trying our best to be, frankly, neutral, because the one seat has been... challenged in the last couple of days. I mean, it's gone back and forth in the last several voting cycles. So it's not that it wasn't competitive, but I put together something I thought lived by the rules. I think what we got is something different. And so I felt like, personally, I voted for it because I thought it ought to be challenged. Number two is I think there's a problem if every law you have is simply based on referendum and coming from the people. This is, and I say that carefully because this is... That's democracy, I get it, but we're a republic. And to keep things, shall we say, in check and running without the chaos, the republic part of this means you elect representatives, you go in, you have hearings. They didn't. We had hours of hearings to even get our bill together. The judge didn't. There's no personal or public input. It was just the public process is different. And so my personal opinion is it has its place. In extreme cases, but the legislature, based on being representatives of the people, has a little better role in keeping things stable and more consistent.
Okay. Mike, I sure appreciate your time and your input. Happy holidays.
Same to you. Thank you.
That's State Representative Mike Kohler. Again, he represents Wasatch County as well as a portion of Summit County. And on the phone now to give us a perspective from the Democrats, I have Utah State Senator Nate Bowen, who's also running for the 1st Congressional District based on the map that was approved by the district court judge. Good morning to you, Nate. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Leslie. Good morning.
Since the issue that's the issue that touches you with regard to the districting map, let's get your response. Yesterday's special session seemed to be more about condemning our court and judges than the actions that the Republican-dominated legislature took that got us here in the first place. Again, accusations of gerrymandering a map that ensures that all of Utah's 4 congressional districts remain Republican.
Yeah, I think yesterday's special session was really an opportunity for the Republicans to show off how much they are willing to protect the power of the billionaires and the folks that are really protected by the legislature. And so we saw them trying to preserve the maps that they've pushed forward in the past, and to condemn the judiciary that we've had here in Utah that's done a great job over recent years. And so it was really frustrating to see what came out of that. The language that's being used about our judiciary is really dangerous, and we've seen some judges come under fire in recent months. And I think the whole narrative here that we don't have a fair map now is just ridiculous, because in the past, I just heard, I think it was Representative Kohler talking about the urban and rural mix of districts we've had. All that was doing was just diluting urban votes with rural voters. We have, a congressional district and a half worth of population in Salt Lake County, but we've not had representation from Salt Lake County and D.C. For a long time. And so it is really frustrating that this narrative keeps getting pushed along. And I think what we've got now is a fair process, and we'll see that iterated on in the future as the ballot initiative that was passed plays out. But right now, the Republicans are just angry that they are going to lose a seat, and they're making that well known.
Yeah. And as you heard from Representative Kohler, I mean, he said, even if you gave this map, gave the state map to a 10-year-old, it's like divide the state up. That 10-year-old wouldn't do what has been done. I mean, right? Drawing a circle around Salt Lake City.
I think they would. I mean, I would say my current state senate seat, for instance, is I live in Mill Creek. I represent a few cities right around this area. The previous districts that we had all came together in Mill Creek along a short section of road on 39th South, I believe. And so my current district overlapped with 3 of the 4 congressional districts. And that doesn't make sense. I mean, they split up basically like a pizza pie. And I think if you look at, the population of the state, these districts are based on population. They're not based on geography. They're based on communities of interest. We have rural communities in the state that have not been well represented either under the current districts, because they are, to some extent, getting diluted by urban voters. And so I think it makes total sense to have one district in one of the most urbanized states in the country, by the way. Utah, our population is very concentrated along the Wasatch Front and in Washington County. And so it makes sense to have at least one representative that represents more of an urban community, and we can focus on more urban issues like affordable housing and childcare. And I mean, those are statewide issues as well, but it's certainly really bad along the Wasatch Front. And then we have someone, who can represent the rural agricultural communities, the extractive industries, if that's what they want to do, things like that. And I think that makes total sense. That gives us some better balance than trying to split everyone to know all of those issues, because honestly, we're better served by having members of this is a little bit tangential to the argument about redistricting, but from a political and procedural perspective, I think we are better served having representation from both parties in D.C., because then no matter who's in power, actually we have a seat at the table.
Yeah. And how helpful or perhaps how dangerous is it when we have state representatives saying that the public can't trust our courts, or then that they have tarnished themselves?
It's so dangerous, because those judges were confirmed mostly unanimously by the legislature. So they came through a nominating process, were appointed by the Republican governor, confirmed by the supermajority Republican Senate, and became judges. And so the notion that they are these, partisan hacks that these people are saying they are is just crazy. it's inaccurate, and it creates this complete sense of mistrust in our judiciary that I think undermines trust in government as a whole. And, you know, right now people are very frustrated, and I think it's a good thing to take some of the politics out of this and to have a judiciary that is trusted and reputable. And so to see the legislature really, you know, pointing their fingers at the judiciary, you know, in particular some members of the Supreme Court and Judge Gibson, who has ruled on the redistricting case. I think that's dangerous. And you know, it was just frankly laughable to see the governor recently talking about how we might add justices to the Supreme Court, but somehow that wouldn't be court packing, I think was the words he used, which is, I mean, that's the definition of court packing. So if that's the direction they go, I mean, I think it completely dispels the notion that Utah is some, you know, exceptional state that is beyond the influence of national politics, because that is certainly core to the notion of things that we're seeing from Trump in D.C., you know, this takeover of unilateral power that he's shooting for there. So it's really dangerous.
So now what? The map stands that Judge Gibson approved, or is just until we get another ruling from the Supreme Court?
Yeah, so the Supreme Court has been very clear so far that the process we've gone through is going to stand up. So I think we're going to see the current map stand up despite what we did last night, which was to push some filing deadlines back and to change some rules of the game in the courts to make the appeals process for this map that the Republicans in the legislature don't like a bit more straightforward. And so it really complicates the elections process. I mean, the Republicans keep talking about how confusing and how last minute, you know, and how doing all the things in the court have made this really unclear to the public. And I think they're just feeding into that by trying to change the rules in the middle of the game. And so that's what we're seeing here. And, you know, I expect this will stand up for now, but the Republicans will keep pressing. They'll keep spending taxpayer dollars on these appeals, and they'll keep trying to change the makeup of the courts so they get decisions they like. I mean, we just saw probably the most conservative justice confirmed to the Utah Supreme Court we've seen in a long time. And so that's, I think, an indication of where things are going.
All right. Back to the repeal of the ban on public employee units. Unions. As I mentioned to Representative Kohler earlier, lawmakers were touting this bill earlier this year. And, you know, now a change of heart, given, you know, that it was going to go on to the November 2026 ballot. What he told me is that he thinks what we need to do is just split up those unions, you know, that the UEA should absolutely be treated differently than our police and fire personnel. Do you agree with that?
Wow, I missed that part of the conversation. No, I do not agree with that. I think that is really scary to talk about splitting up unions because we don't like the influence they have. That's the point. You know, these are members of the same profession that have similar working conditions, similar jobs, that get to come together and fight collectively for better workplace conditions, better pay and wages and benefits, and to make sure that the profession is treated with the respect it deserves. And certainly with teachers, I think they continue to be under fire from the legislature in particular, but also just the conservative wing of American politics right now. So that's scary to hear that. I think unions are a good thing. I think we need to strengthen them. Utah is already one of the least friendly states in the country to organize labor. And you mentioned my congressional run. I mean, passing additional protections in D.C. For unions like the PRO Act would be a priority of mine. And I think that we need those backstops in Utah, because the attacks we've seen with 267 and others are extremely concerning, and really would impact the ability of teachers to do their job. We've already seen the public education system weakened in so many ways, and that would just go even further.
Okay. I'm out of time. I'm going to leave it there. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Leslie.
Happy holidays. That's State Senator Nate Blauen. Park City Council meets tomorrow, starting in work session at about 4:25 to discuss golf capital improvements. In the studio with a preview of the meeting, I have Acting City Manager Jody Emery along with Deputy City Manager Heather Snedden. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The golf course is what's called an enterprise fund, meaning that its revenues must match its expenditures. The city hired a consultant to look into the future needs of the golf course, and they identified about $6.7 million in capital improvements. The city had already identified about $1 million in those same improvements. So what are the other $5.5 million in unaddressed capital needs?
You know, we have several that our consultant has recommended. That's True Club Solutions. The main priority, which the city agrees with, is the irrigation system. We've got some main lines that are 30 plus years old. They need some replacement. We have green complexes, bunker renovation, some fairway contouring that the consultant would recommend. We have some items that the staff has actually been actively working on, and those include, we've got some maintenance equipment, some cart path repair that has been underway, road crossings, an equipment lift that we're considering, footbridges and green waste hauling, and then we'd also like some council direction on a couple of items, whether to reseed the fairways and a potential fuel tank.
Okay, so the revenues are going to fall short about $3 million. So what's the staff recommending? Do you make a transfer or take a loan from the general fund?
Those are a couple of options that are on the table. Our main purpose for the meeting today is really to align with the city council on the priorities for these capital improvements and to take the first step, which we believe is to issue a request for statement of qualifications and hire a landscape architect to help us identify the path forward, particularly with the irrigation system and a couple of other items. And once we understand the strategy from a landscape architect and the cost associated with a number of these improvements, we'll come back to council to present our recommendation.
Okay, there are some challenges ahead for the golf course because it will be expected to start paying for its water use. Has that been implemented? Was that implemented this summer?
That is going to be implemented. And so far, we think the golf fund is in a pretty good place with a $3 million balance. But we do have some changes that are going to come, and we'll be analyzing those as we go forward.
Okay. Later on, after the swearing-in of the new canine police dog, Officer Bruno, the council will discuss the naming of the new community center at City Park. It's not even built yet, but we are naming it the Mine at City Park. Do you guys have any insight into why this name was chosen? Of course, we have a mining reference, but I see a brand-new building, light and, you know, bright, not damp, dark mine.
Well, the proposed name came through staff and public input, including the Recreation Advisory Board and the Youth Recreation Advisory Board. It had strong support from both advisory boards, and they feel that the mine reflects Park City's mining heritage, which is the obvious one. But it also creates it's an idea of a place of energy, activity, gathering. It resonates with the kids, the families, and longtime locals. So council's action tomorrow is simply to formally adopt the name. And the idea is to bring clarity as construction continues. It's estimated to be completed in December of 2026. But the committee chose to emphasize the City Park location rather than Park City. And the idea is really to differentiate it from other community buildings and community groups, including the Park City Community Church and the Senior Center, Park City Learning Center. So the idea is to really address this as a city park.
Okay. Council will get a Recreate 248 update. And I guess why is this coming before council now? There's really no policy decisions being requested here.
This is really an update for the council, just to let the council know where we are with the Recreate 248 transit study and alternatives analysis. So we're explaining where we are with the level 2 evaluation of the project, and that really is an evaluation of the two different modes that the transportation department is looking at, which are buses, either through the center lanes or the sides, or a light rail. And they're evaluating the criteria they've identified are transit performance, equity and access, cost and feasibility, the environmental impacts, and long-term resiliency of these two different modes, and getting some data for that. And once we have gone through that process, we'll be coming back in January to give the recommendation for the locally preferred alternative, either a bus or light rail, and then hopefully proceed to environmental review, which will take some time for the corridor.
Okay. We haven't even gotten the bus rapid transit lanes up and running, and now we're talking about straight to light rail possibly?
Well, it's one of the modes that we're considering that we've been directed by council to at least consider. So we are doing that, and when we come back, we'll hopefully get some recommendations from council on how they'd like to proceed.
Since it is a state highway, how much say does Park City have?
You know, that's a good question. I do think we have been working closely with UDOT in our evaluation of this alternatives analysis, and we've been positioning ourselves well in order to seek some state funding as well, particularly through the UDOT and Transportation Investment Fund, but also positioning ourselves for some federal grants. So we've been working closely with UDOT. I think we'll have we have a good relationship there, and we do have some input on the project.
So could residents be paying for some of those upgrades, even though it is a state highway?
You know, potentially, but right now the funding strategy is really focused on getting state dollars as well as federal dollars to pay for it. So I think we're well positioned for the funding.
All right. And it was put out years ago in terms of just widening it to include two lanes both directions without the hourglass happening in both directions. Is that back on the table?
You know, I don't know the answer to that one, Leslie. I'd have to check for you.
All right. Council also being asked to approve a contract to design the Snow Creek Tunnel. This is a $1.6 million contract. Where's the proposed location for this?
You know, it's really underneath 248, probably aligned with the Snow Creek Drive intersection, but the exact landing points on each side are still to be determined. It's going to require some work and negotiation with landowners on each side. Because we will need right-of-way for this tunnel to go in. And we need to get further down the line with the designs in order to have some effective communications with those landowners so that they know what they're looking at and what we might be able to make work.
Okay, we're talking basically the bank and then on the other side where the theaters are?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
The tunnel is estimated to cost $16.7 million. Where do you get money like that?
We do have some of the money already set aside and planned for this particular project. Right now, we have some funding sources, including a walkability bond, a UDOT TIF active grant, the transit fund, the third quarter sales tax. And we also have Snyder Basin Water Reclamation District, who has committed $1.5 million. So right now, we have project funding that is nearing $13 million. Now, we'll have some additional funds that we will need to identify as we move forward with this project, but we're in a pretty good position in terms of funding.
Okay. How soon could it be built?
Now, right now, we are looking at potentially March 2027 to proceed with construction. We'll be pursuing, or we have pursued the RSOQ to identify our consultant, Methans Consulting, and they'll be identifying two alternatives with the enhancements that the City Council has recommended, and then we'll be comparing that with the original tunnel plan that we had presented, as well as a Hawk crossing, and identifying, you know, the pros and cons of each of those potential options and getting some input from Council on those before we proceed.
Yeah, what happened to the Hawk, like, that was signal that was supposed to go up there?
You know, we consulted with UDOT about the Hawk signal, and they do not support implementing a Hawk crossing if we are going to build a tunnel within the next 5 years. So we are evaluating the tunnel option to determine whether council would like to proceed with that and the design alternatives and the costs. And if that's not going to be built within the next 5 years, it may be that a Hawk signal is back on the table.
Got it. Okay, council also set to approve another supplemental plan, the final one, a level 5 special event permit for the Sundance Film Festival. Anything from years past that's different about this? Or
there are some venue changes to start with. So the Doubletree has been added as a theater venue. And notably, the Egyptian Theater has been removed as a screening venue this year, though they will have a panel discussion that's focused on the legacy of Sundance in Park City. There will be expanded Main Street activations that are coordinated with the HPCA and the Chamber, as well as a full 10-day screening schedule at the Eccles Theater. That is the largest venue in Park City, as well as an exclusive in-person festival for the first week. I think this is the first time they'll do that since COVID. So it used to be split with in-person and hybrid options after COVID, but this year it'll be exclusively in-person.
And will Main Street be closed to cars?
It will be. So the, let me get The Main Street will be closed from, looks like, 11 a.m. to 3 a.m. for the first 5 days. And we will be, there will be access passes, as usual, delivered door-to-door for Old Town, both residences and businesses, so that they maintain their access to their residences and businesses.
Okay. And when Main Street is open, it will be two-way? We're not doing the...
Correct. As far as I know.
Okay. Anything else you think people need to know about Sundance?
Well, there will be additional transit, so we're really focused on building a robust transit opportunity there. So 20-minute Richardson flat service from 6 a.m. to 2 a.m., so making sure that we get all the workers in and out, and we don't leave them stranded in town, as well as Sundance is providing two internal routes as well, so they're supplementing the transit services. Those are primarily between the venues, but then also between, I believe, Fresh Market and Main Street.
Okay. Is the city planning any kind of Sundance farewell?
Well, what we're focused on is trying to add some activations to Main Street. We'd really like to celebrate and make sure that we're adding as much as we can to the festival. So we are looking, if anybody is interested, for opportunities to activate on Main Street, we would love to have you talk to Chris Finney in our special events office so you could reach out. So we're working with the Historic Main Street Alliance and also the Park City Chamber of Commerce to work on that, but we would love additional input or ideas for that.
Okay. Wanted to get a little bit more information about the fraudulent emails apparently attacking the city's
yes.
building department. Is that right?
Yeah, we really want to, we've increased our communication around this because it's concerning to us. We've had a number of people reporting that they have received fraudulent emails. They are falsely claiming to be from city staff. They are attempting to solicit payment through wire transfers or gift cards. So we've heard of at least three people being targeted for this. The Park City Police Department is investigating these, but we want to reiterate that legitimate communications will only come from a verified .gov email address, and Park City will never request a wire transfer. We will never ask for a gift card, and we will never direct applicants to, you know, quote, only respond to this email. That's what a lot of these are trying to do. You may only talk to me through this email. So if you have received a suspicious communication or you're concerned about one, please reach out to our planning department, or you can actually call the Summit County Non-Emergency Dispatch, which is a good number to have in your phone, and that's 435-615-3600.
Okay. So are the names that these emails coming from legitimate city employees?
They are. So AI is very sophisticated, as we know, and it's getting more sophisticated. So yes, they're being sent from names within our city departments.
Okay.
And one thing I might add, Leslie, is I think that a majority of those are coming from our, supposedly from our planning department. So be particularly aware if you've submitted an application to our planning department.
Yes.
Okay. When does the winter transit schedule start? We've got a big celebration happening at 9 a.m. with the 50-year celebration. Yeah.
Absolutely. That launched December 7th. So we're bringing more frequent service to the 1 red, 2 green, and 3 blue routes. And the return of the Park City Mountain and Deer Valley Express routes for Richardson Flat Park and Ride, and the return of the citywide late night route. And we have continued service on the 2010 route. And more of that information is available on our website.
Okay. Everyone's invited to what? Join you at the Transit Center? Is that where it's going to be?
At 9 a.m. So in 9 minutes, we'll meet you down there to take a ride on the trolley with the mayor.
Okay. And briefly, what do residents need to know about the upcoming city council appointment process?
So it will be opening soon. It depends on when Ryan Dickey, formally resigned. So he's indicated that he plans to formally resign from the city council shortly after the December 18th meeting, similar to how Mayor Worrell managed it. And the application window is expected to open by December 23rd. Applications will be accepted through January 5th. So we recognize it's a short window and it's during the holidays, so we want to make sure that we're communicating as much as we can about this. We'd love everybody who's interested to apply. The timing is guided by state law, so we are stuck with this schedule, so we'll be doing our best to be as transparent and communicative as possible.
Okay. Jody Emery, Heather Snedden, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Leslie.
On the phone now with an update from the Heber Valley Chamber, it's Jessica Turner, Public Relations Manager for the Heber Valley Chamber. Good morning. Thanks for joining us, Jessica.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so lots of holiday activities. Let's start with one of the most popular, the North Pole. Pole Express. It sounds like, though, it's too late to get on board this year.
Yes, you know, tickets are a hot commodity around here. Tickets typically go on sale the first week of June, which is early in the season, and they sell out fairly quickly. I would say by August, September, most dates are fully sold out. However, this year, the Heber Valley Railroad was able to add some additional train cars. They've been in the process for about a little over a year trying to get some of these new train cars in stock and on the line. They were able to do that in time for North Pole Express, and these are a higher end experience because they have a glass dome ceiling. So it's a completely new car they've added onto the existing train. So there may still be a few tickets left. They are going to be at a little bit of a higher price point, but those trains run through the end of the month. So if you are still looking, it is still possible to get a ticket or two.
Oh, great. Okay. Let's see. A lot of activities just due to the holiday. So let's get through some of those. Tell
Correct.
Us what's going on.
Yeah, we've got a lot of opportunities to see and visit Santa and engage in other very festive happenings around town. So the holiday lights. Now, in the past couple of years, Rocky Mountain Outfitters has ran their holiday lights with wagon rides over at Jordanelle State Park. This year, they have moved it over to Wasatch Mountain State Park. I'm not sure the reason for the decision to have a new location, but we are hoping that they end up with a lot of participation and a lot of riders that come out. They do have Santa and Mrs. Claus on site for each of those rides as well. And they've created a really wonderful walk through a forested area with some holiday lights before you get on the wagon rides to go through additional holiday lights. So again, that's happening over at Wasatch Mountain State Park through the end of the month. And then we've got a live nativity event that is put on by Miro Industries, and they partner with another company over here locally to help host this live nativity event. That is tonight. So if you do have a free evening and you're looking to add some holiday cheer to your schedule, that will be happening at the Wasatch County Events Center. There's a 6 p.m. Showing, and then immediately following that, a 7:30 p.m. showing. So they do back-to-back showings one night only tonight at the Events Center. Idell Playhouse and Avon are bringing in some Christmas concerts for the season. The next two coming up will be tomorrow and then this weekend, so December 11th and December 13th. Check their schedule to find out who all they're bringing in for the remainder of the month. They've done a phenomenal job, though, of restoring the historic theaters of Avon and Ideal, and they're really being aggressive on creating a robust calendar with diverse performances, a lot of cover bands, a lot of plays and musicals that they're bringing in, some great runs for movies that are either first run or previously released, and combining those with really fun activations. So check out their schedule if you're looking for something to do on a weekday or even a weekend night. And then back again this year is the Festival of Crushes, which is the nativity sets. They bring in hundreds and hundreds of these nativity sets from all around the world, a lot of them from a private collection that is donated short term from a local family in Midway. They put them on display at Midway Town Hall and also at the private residence with select dates and times, largely over the weekends, and that will run each weekend through December 21st. I make this part of my personal holiday festivities each year because the beauty in these crushes or these nativity sets is just mind-blowing. Not just the number of sets that they display, but the fact that they can source them from literally anywhere across the world and the type of material that is used to represent these different countries and cultures. It's really quite an amazing thing to behold. Then we've got two local theater groups, both Timpanogos Valley Theater and High Valley Arts, that put on Christmas productions. Timpanogos Valley Theater will be featuring Miracle on 34th Street. Fun fact, I will actually be part of the cast this year, so happy to be able to share that. We open on Friday, December 12th, and it runs through December 20th, select dates. All performances will be at 7 p.m. And then High Valley Arts is going to be producing a Christmas Carol musical this year. That will be at Midway Town Hall. The dates for that will be December 13th through the 23rd, with select dates, and all those show times will start at 7 p.m. as well. Then new this year, circling kind of back over to Heber Valley Railroad, they're going to be putting on some New Year's Eve trains this year. They've got all that information on their website. It is new with the new train cars that they've added onto the line, and those will run the day before New Year's Eve through New Year's Day. So check their website for the dates and times on that. Gather some information. They are daytime trains, so if you do have New Year's Eve plans and festivities in the evening, you can still catch the train during the day, fill your day with that fun activity, and then head on to your party, your soiree, your dinner, whatever you may be doing for New Year's Eve. That rounds us out for now through kind of New Year's. But a couple of events I want to just put out there and get on the radar is the Wasatch Citizen Series ski races happening at Soldier Hollow. Those will happen January 3rd and 31st, and that is a series that happens every winter season with races that take place at Soldier Hollow, and that's part of that race series. And then Skijoring Utah, they have actually partnered up and enhanced their offerings to join now with Pro Skijor, and they're going to be hosting a series of races throughout the Intermountain region, and they're kicking off the first of those races here in Heber. So over MLK weekend, which is a popular ski weekend, and there's several things happening, including FIS at World Cup at Deer Valley. In addition, Skijoring will be happening on the 16th and 17th, that Friday and Saturday in January.
Okay. Hey, that's a lot. Lots of fun things to do. Jessica, I appreciate your time, and I'll do a quick mention here of some of the chamber events coming up. Appreciate your time.
Okay. Thank you.
Jessica Turner, again, Public Relations Manager with Heber Valley Chamber. Tonight is their mixer at Midway Mercantile, 4 to 6, and then the sign-up for the Chamber Year-End Review and Annual Awards happening January 20th.